Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 14th of June. Fierce fighting between Hamas and Fatah in the Gaza Strip yesterday and today, and there is news this morning that Hamas fighters have overrun one of the Fatah movement's most important security installations in the Gaza Strip. The victors took the gunmen into the street and shot them to death, execution style. Palestine liberation organizations today are recommending that Abbas declare a state of emergency and dismantle Fatah's governing coalition with Hamas. A spokesman for the Hamas militant told Hamas Radio the era of justice and Islamic rule have arrived. There's also action in the southern Gaza town of Rafah. Hamas took over the preventive security building, the second main Gaza city to fall to the militants. And the violence has upset a lot of people who live there. I don't know if you saw these news reports yesterday with dozens of Palestinians saying enough of this violence, and they actually strayed into a gun battle. The pictures of that were rather dramatic. We're going to be talking about all of this. And we're talking about the response of the United States, the response of the European community, and the response of Israel. Israel saying they would not intervene unless Hamas took over Gaza and started attacking Israel. And there is concern about the possibility of that happening. So we're going to talk about all of this this hour. And our guest is Professor Ami Pedazur. He is an associate professor in the Departments of Government and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas, also a senior fellow at the National Security Studies Center at the University of Haifa in Israel. His main fields of interest are terrorism and political extremism. Professor Pedazur serves as an associate editor of the journals Studies in Conflict and Terrorism and Democracy and Security. He's also the book review editor of the Civil Wars Journal. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Professor Ami Pedazur, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
I was quite struck yesterday by these news images amid all this horror, all this violence, dozens of Palestinians walking right into a gun battle saying, stop this.
Well, I think that it was a very touching moment because these people were just tired of what's going on there. Many people just don't find it hard to figure out what are the causes for these clashes. And the people of Gaza suffered for so many years from the Israeli occupation, from influences from outside the Gaza Strip. And now, finally, when Israel withdrew and things could have turned better, this violent wave of violence erupts. And I think that they are just sick of it, and many of them just don't know what are the causes for this.
Yes. It must be horrible to live there right now. The hospitals are overwhelmed. There is not enough food coming in. You can't leave your house. You must feel like you're under a total state of siege.
Yeah, it's true. Gaza is the most densely populated area in the world.
Really?
Yeah, and therefore it's just, they're really under siege because the borders are closed. The situation economically is terrible. Situation in the West Bank is much better despite the closure. And therefore, I gather there is absolutely no hope for the people there.
Mm-hmm. You asked the causes of these clashes. Let me present that to you as a major question here. What are the causes of these clashes?
Well, that's a good question because it seems to be a question of a struggle between Hamas and Fatah over the dominance or dominant role in this place. But I think that there are many other actors that are involved. Predominantly, Iran is backing Hamas, and of course, within the Gaza Strip, the structure or the political structure is very much based on primordial ties on extended families, on tribal politics. So I would guess that there are some elements within Hamas that started this wave of violence. I wouldn't think that Ismail Haniyeh, the prime minister, or the dominant ministers were involved. I think that it's more of a local phenomenon, and that many of the youngsters who take part in these fights are not really ideological. They just, you know, they join it without any kind of specific ideology behind it.
Mm-hmm. And they're very young, many of them, aren't they? Very young.
They are. It's hard to know. You know, it's almost like Iraq now. The information that flows from the Gaza Strip is very scarce. It's hard to follow it. But these are young gang members. Most of them are not even soldiers or trained militarily. So it's just I would compare it to street gangs rather than to, you know, organized military structures.
Yeah. If you would, please, outline the major differences between Fatah and Hamas.
Well, Fatah is an organization that that was the dominant nationalistic force within the Palestinian arena. It was formed by Yasser Arafat in the late 1950s and then took over the PLO in the 1960s. This was the, in Arabic, it means that it's the movement for the liberation of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And they had very minor religious element within their ideology. Hamas, on the other hand, was formed in 1987, just prior to the First Intifada, and it's based on the Muslim Brothers in Egypt. And the ideology is, I would say, predominantly religious, and then the nationalistic element comes second. And over the years, Hamas has always been dominant in Gaza, while Fatah had more influence in the West Bank. And we have to remember that Gaza was occupied by Israel from Egypt in 1967 and the West Bank from Jordan. So despite the fact that both areas are considered to be Palestinian areas, their structure, the economy, the social fabric, etc., are very different.
Yeah. So if you had the government ruled primarily by Hamas compared to a government ruled, I know they're trying to share power right now, but that's fallen apart. So if you had a Hamas-ruled government, Islamic rule would prevail?
I would guess so. I'm not sure what it means in terms of their foreign policies, because they still need to govern and they must supply basic services to the citizens there.
Mm-hmm.
But domestically, I would imagine that they'll try to enforce some kind of Islamic rule. I think that would be much easier for them to do in Gaza compared to the West Bank, which is, you have cities like Ramallah, which are very modern and Western-oriented.
Mm-hmm. There have been calls, I'm sure you know, today that, there have been calls for Fatah to, for this government to dissolve, for this power-sharing government to just absolutely, the coalition, a state of emergency to be declared, and that Abbas declare Fatah's governing coalition with Hamas over. You think that's going to happen?
Well, you know, they don't govern at this point, so what's the point? And I wouldn't blame the leadership of Hamas, neither the people in Gaza or the West Bank, nor the leaders from Khaled Mashal and others from Syria. I don't think that they are behind this. I think that it's much more of a local phenomenon. I just don't see the point in this government, as long as you cannot really, you don't have the monopoly over the use of force and you cannot really govern. So I think that de facto this government is not doing anything at this point. And for Abbas, it would be a smart move to disengage from this whole thing.
What do you mean? What's the local phenomena?
I mean that the whole wave of violence, it's easy to portray in terms of Hamas versus Fatah.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't hear the Prime Minister, Ismail Haniyeh, from Hamas supporting this violence. And and there is no, from what I gather, and I try to follow the news from the Middle East, I don't see a top-down phenomenon here. I see, I would say that it's probably led by leaders of Hamas in Gaza. But we have to remember that today, Gaza, there are so many actors involved there. Iran is having a major role, Hezbollah. Some families associated themselves with Al-Qaeda. So, again, it's very hard to really identify who the major actors are. It's quite obvious that Fatah is being pushed out. But I just heard a couple of minutes ago that Mohammed Dahlan and his people blame many of the soldiers within the Fatah forces, they argued that they collaborated with Hamas and the other faction. So again, the picture is very blurry, and it's hard to come up with a conclusive description of events there.
Right. And Iran would be involved in terms of what? Sending in weapons or?
Oh, yeah. Even training. It's been known for the last couple of months that Hamas operatives are going through Egypt to Iran, and they are being trained in special camps. And there are all kinds of military professions that are being indoctrinated to them, and they are just... And they come back to the Gaza Strip with all this knowledge. I'm not just talking about guerrilla warfare, even engineering and things like, you know, they want, Iran is very interested in turning Gaza to a second Lebanon in order to have a forefront for fighting Israel from the south. So they are being trained in building bunkers and in rocket launching, etc.
I heard this impassioned plea from a father on the radio yesterday who was just beside himself, saying that he cannot understand Palestinians killing Palestinians. What is the hope for any kind of future at all for a Palestinian state or for a time free of violence for his six-year-old daughter? And he was really on the verge of tears here. This must be very difficult. I mean, the question is, of course, why would Palestinians be killing Palestinians?
I would put it in broader terms of a civil war. I know that many of us would immediately go to the question of what's happening in the Middle East, but we see civil wars in different parts of the world, and it's always the question what leads, you know, people to kill their brothers and their fellow citizens. And this is—it's always complicated. I think that despite what we think, there is no Palestinian state. They are still in their formation stage, and there are, you know, there are various factions aspiring for gaining power. Having said that, I'm just, you know, struck by the level of cruelty and brutality that is being portrayed. The descriptions are just horrific.
Yes, they are.
And I honestly cannot explain that. I just sometimes it's you know, you don't expect it to be so close to. And I've visited the place, and it doesn't. You know, it doesn't make any sense. But again, I would just, you know, take it back. If these are not warriors, these are not soldiers. It's just young individuals who are, you know, caught in this very aggressive battle, and the level of, you know, hatred, animosity. It's just I think that they are in an ecstatic mode or something like that, because otherwise, it's just impossible to explain. It doesn't seem like a systematic ethnic cleansing or something of a sort, but just, you know, an eruption of unbelievable violence.
Mm-hmm. Hospitals operating without water, electricity, and blood. People are unable to get food in the area. Relief agencies are unable to do a great deal of work because they have been under fire, and they've been under violence as well. How is it that the world can respond to what I'm sure must be a growing humanitarian crisis there?
Well, I think that the world has, you know, the world is always slow in responding to these crises. And I honestly cannot give policy recommendations. I just think that there must be an immediate intervention of the UN or any kind of, or the EU or any kind of agency that would be acceptable by the Palestinians, just to help, first of all, help people get out of there, because the borders, of course, to Israel and to Egypt are closed, and at the same time, just to, you know, ask the factions there. And I'm not sure if it's going to work. This is the role of the Palestinian government to allow some kind of ceasefire, just to help people get food, get, you know, what they need for the hospitals, etc. But to be honest, I don't think that Israel is going to do anything. Israel wants to distance itself as much as possible from the whole situation. I think that Egypt is quite frustrated, and from what I hear from Cairo, they are giving up. They don't know what to do anymore. So my heart goes to the people of Gaza, who are just, you know, completely devastated by the whole situation.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest is Professor Ami Pedazur. He is associate professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. His special areas are terrorism and political extremism. And we're talking about the fierce fighting between Fatah and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. And we start our calls with Don from New Auburn. Hello, Don.
Yeah. You know, they had a duly, freely election by the Palestinians, and then somebody is low down enough not to honestly recognize that the election and then steal their money, like Israel has done, and continuously harass these people. It's a horror that should never happen in no place in the world, and we're condoning it for 30 to 50, 40 to 50 years. And unless we get some decent people in Washington that just simply say, stop, I'm not for either side. Just say, stop, go back to your territories, allow these people a chance to live, and quit this criminal occupation that has been going on for these people for 40 years here. That's strictly against international law, it's against human rights, and Israel is totally responsible for the effects of what they've caused over there. And we have to have sense enough to say, stop it. Just stop it. We are not going to continue funding your illegal operations.
Professor Pedazur.
Well, I just, I don't want to go into a political debate here. I think that the problem now in Gaza is definitely connected to the occupation. However, Israel withdrew from Gaza in the summer of 2005, and it's just the question is today, if we're focusing on the situation today, I think that it doesn't really have a lot to do with Israel. It has to do with the outcomes of the occupation, maybe the structure that of the Palestinian society that or the Palestinian regime that collapsed because of the occupation, but at the same time we have to remember that this is an internal Palestinian issue that we are dealing with, and Israel has very little to do with it.
What about Israel's concern that if Hamas takes over Gaza, there could be, they said they wouldn't intervene unless they took over Gaza and started attacking Israel. Do you fear that could happen?
Well, of course. first of all, the gentleman said something that I totally agree with, and this is the fact that they held free elections, and there is no reason, if you endorse democracy, not to allow them to receive the funding that they are entitled to. You know, if you endorse democracy, you have to accept it, no matter what the outcomes are. As for reoccupying Gaza, Israel has always have more interest in the West Bank than Gaza for ideological, strategic, and theological reasons. Mm-hmm. And even as early as the First Intifada, there were calls to withdraw from Gaza. I don't think that Israel has any interest in reoccupying Gaza. The problem is that from the northern part of the Gaza Strip, rockets are being launched at the city of Sderot, and Israel has no, at this point, no real answer to this problem of rockets. After solving the problem of suicide bombers, the tactic shifted into rocket launching, and Israel is trying to cope with it by haunting those units of rocket launchers, but this seems to be very ineffective. So I think that it would take a lot more for Israel to invade Gaza, but eventually if things are going to deteriorate and mm-hmm. Israel would gather that it becomes a major strategic threat, there wouldn't be any other alternative. I just want to say that one other thing that we tend to dismiss, yes, it's true that Israel has a lot to do with the situation there, and I'm not representing Israel here in any way, but it's important to remember that there are other countries involved there trying to manipulate things for their own purposes. And I strongly suggest looking at Iran as a major actor in this thing.
Thanks, John, for the call. Zach from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Yeah. Dr. Pedizer, I find it surprising that you're a little shocked by the level of atrocities being committed. I think it's quite obvious that this is a natural result of the type of educational system that is going on in the Palestinian areas. People are, brought up to worship violence and martyrs and death, and I just think that this is the result which we're seeing. For a long time, the Arab world applauded suicide bombings against Israel, but now look at who are the biggest victims of suicide bombers. They're predominantly Muslim Arab Iraqis. And I think when you ride a tiger, it's a very dangerous thing, and this is the result. And regarding elections in Hamas, I don't really consider them completely democratic elections. I think elections are more than just a vote. I mean, what about freedom of press and other things that don't exist within the Palestinian Authority? So I don't really think we can consider those elections to be fair democratic elections as we understand them in the West. I will take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I think that the freedom of press in the Palestinian Authority is quite remarkable compared to other parts of the world. And I think that in terms of the atrocities, it's true that there was for many years a culture of martyrdom that was embraced by a minority of the Palestinian people. But we have to remember that it's not a trait of the Middle East. And you'll speak to many people who live in the Middle East, and they do not have any kind of affinity towards violence. So I wouldn't generalize. I think that we can talk for hours about how this whole idea of martyrdom and suicide operations was embraced by the Palestinian society, but I don't think that it's something that is natural to the Palestinians, and therefore I just I think that it requires some more analysis to figure out what's happening now and how come violence became so acceptable and so cruel in Gaza. And we have to remember that the situation in the West Bank is very much under control, and not to mention East Jerusalem and other places. So I wouldn't refer to it as a trait of the Palestinians in particular or the Arab world in general.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. We're talking about the fierce fighting between Fatah and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and it is continuing with news today that Hamas fighters overran one of the Fatah movement's most important security installations in the Gaza Strip. Victors took the gunmen into the street and shot them to death, execution style. The level of violence and the level of horror here is terrible. And we're looking at how it's difficult for the world to respond to this and the level of humanitarian concern there is, but we can't get people in to help the humanitarian concerns, the hospitals that don't have electricity, that people can't get food because these organizations are under attack as well. And trying to look at the roots of this, the roots of the violence between these factions and the involvement of other countries. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. One line is open. We go to Amy from Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I do think that the answer to all this is that the occupation, the Israeli occupation, must end. I think the idea that Israel has withdrawn from the Gaza Strip is a myth, because Israel, as just reported by the World Bank, is still controlling the borders of Gaza and has many checkpoints there. They've created a pressure cooker in Gaza. It's not surprising that the violence has turned inward. When you create a pressure cooker like that, it's like some evil sociological experiment going on when you have such a densely populated area where people have no hope, their economy is in ruins, and Israel still controls everything. I think that the occupation has to end there, and people have to be given some sort of hope. The fact that Israel won't recognize Hamas is also a big problem because it makes that government ineffective, and then it allows for the possibility that other groups will try to replace Hamas, unfortunately, through violent means. But I do think that it has everything to do with the fact of the occupation.
And yet, how do you deal, though, Amy, with, as our guest was talking about, the involvement of countries like Iran in giving arms, in trying to foster an ideology that is a part of Hamas that is also of concern to a lot of other countries in the Middle East? How do you deal with that element here?
Well, I think it goes back to the occupation. You can't just look inside the Gaza Strip to see why this is going on. You have to look outside and see what's creating it. If Israel withdrew from the West Bank and literally withdrew from Gaza and the borders and so forth, and the Palestinians actually had their own state, why would they want other countries to come in to influence them? I think the way to get rid of the influence of other countries is to give the Palestinians their own state, or to create one secular democratic state in all of Israel / Palestine. That's how you get rid of the outside influence. You give these people something to live for, which is a free country where mm-hmm. they actually have rights.
Professor Padazor.
I do not object the idea of giving the Palestinians their own free country. I do not agree. I think that in terms of the occupation in Gaza, indeed Israel has still some control, but Egypt is also involved, and there are borders between Gaza and Egypt, and Israel would love to end any kind of involvement in Gaza. And again, this is unlike the situation in the West Bank. I think that the situation with Iran is not as simple as that. First of all, I do not accept the concept that the Israelis and Palestinians can form now a democratic state on the whole territory, because you know if you go there, you see that the levels of animosity and the mistrust and the hatred, it's just unbelievable. So it will take decades for the two people to find a solution. I wish that we could have had such a solution. But at this point, I think that we should look at it, yes, and I accept the comments that were made that, again, the occupation has a lot to do with it, but things are changing there. And I think that there is no single factor that could explain it. And I think that at this point, if we dismiss the role of other countries and the phenomenon of the global Salafi jihad and the attempts of other factions to influence what happens there, maybe it's nice ideologically to put it that way, but it's not giving us the whole picture.
Well, what is the solution? Who needs to be involved to try and put a stop to this horrendous violence between Fatah and Hamas right now?
Well, I think that first and foremost, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, I think that these are the two major elements. These are the two prominent actors in the scene. I think that Gaza was an Egyptian territory, and there is still a lot of Egyptian influence. And I think that you know the Egyptians are doing whatever they can to come up with a solution. It just at this point, maybe it's a couple of a question of a couple of days or weeks, but at this point it doesn't work because both Saudis and Egyptians tried to reach to broker some kind of agreement between the two factions. And, hours after the signing of the agreements, the violence erupted again. So I think that if there is any kind of hope for negotiations and mediation there, I would definitely think that it should be, it should come from Cairo.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Amy, for the call. We have lines open if you've been trying to get through. Our number is 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Janice from La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Thank you so much. And your guest sounds wonderful, a wonderful person, a man. I actually was so frustrated listening to the guest speaker that they had on the previous hour, the professor from Pepperdine, anyway, that we could just do no wrong in Iraq type of thing and stance. And my question is, I really don't want to ask him, but basically our presence in Iraq, I mean, how has that influenced that whole area as far as violence and killing? To me, it's just a complete chain reaction. I mean, it's like, you know, everybody's fighting over there. Mm-hmm. Good old U.S. is over there killing, and, you know, and I mean, there's so much violence and death and destruction. I mean, it's just devastating for me to be here. For me, it's sinful to kill like that. But, I mean, to me, peace, why don't we go for peace? It's all this, we got to go after them. You know, we got to get the bomb. If they don't get it, we're going to get them. We're going to put the missiles there so we can get them. I mean, it's all aggression instead of, let's all work for peace. 21st century people, we could put the bomb and kill all of us. Let's start working to get to know each other and try to help make people's lives better. Sorry, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call, Professor Pettazur.
I would say amen, you know.
Right.
I think that the U.S. presence in the Middle East has both positive and negative outcomes, you know, because, when you introduce a new force into a region, it takes time for things to reshape around this new presence. And therefore, I think that, for example, U.S. presence put a lot of pressure on Syria and, for example, encourage the opposition movement in Lebanon, which I see as a very promising thing. But at the same time, the violence in Iraq created a new wave of insurgency. And those insurgents, as you can see today in Lebanon, it reminds us of the past, of what happened to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. They came back to their country of origin, and today we see it in the northern part of Lebanon. People are coming back from Iraq and starting a new wave of violence. So I think that, and of course it has a direct influence on the West Bank. We see that all of a sudden Al-Qaeda, that was always rejected by the Palestinians, has presence in Gaza. And again, Iran, which is so much interested in becoming superpower in the region, is also very, very active. And, you know, it's very interesting to see, because many people tend to believe that Iran is predominantly a Shiite force that tries to enforce some kind of Shiite ideology. But, you know, in Gaza, these are all Sunni factions. So I think that even the attempt to try to portray it as a conflict between Sunnis and Shiis is a little bit simplistic. It's just things are quite chaotic, and you can see all kinds of alliances that are based on common interests or even temporary interests in different parts of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks very much for your call. You talked about earlier Egypt and Saudi Arabia's influence in perhaps trying to broker a peace. Do you see any action on their parts that indicates that they would be willing to do this, and how would they become involved? With whom would they meet? What could they do?
Well, that's the big question. I think that you do have leaders there. You have President Abbas, you have Prime Minister Hania, you have representatives of the PLO and Hamas who reside outside of the Palestinian territories, and the question is, how do you enforce? I think that they tried to enforce such agreements, but the problem is that Gaza is, at this point, is quite in a chaotic situation, and even the local leaders of Fatah are not present there. For example, the strongest person in Gaza, Mohammed Dahlan, is in Cairo, and as far as I understand, most of the leaders of the Fatah fled Gaza and moved to Ramallah. So the thing is that at this point there is no clear leadership or force that can enforce such a peace agreement.
Hmm. Well, that's pretty discouraging.
Yeah, but that's, I think that, you know, to be completely honest, I think that Egypt is very, very active in trying to broker peace there. It's just it's just frustrating for them and for the Palestinian leadership, because it became almost a grassroots phenomenon. It's you don't even know who to address there in order to stop the violence.
Yeah. Dave is next from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Just a comment. You know, I think that what we're really observing in Gaza is a full-blown civil war. And, you know, I think we've seen several times in the 20th century what happens when you have a beginning small minority that takes charge of a society. We saw Hitler, who was democratically elected to be the leader of Germany, completely take over, you know, what had been the flower of European civilization and turn it into the, you know, Nazi empire. We saw Mao take over China and influence that society. Millions of people were killed there, and there was a civil war, which I guess in a way is still open because Taiwan is still outside the orbit of communist China. And right now, you know, for the innocent people in Palestine who just want to go to work and live their lives and raise their families, you're forced to try and kind of choose sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there could be some mechanisms that would loosen the immediate control of daily life of either Hamas or the PLO. Just things like where you can keep your money. You know, if there were a way for people to use internet banking so that their money could, in essence, be offshore, not so easily stolen. And for the Palestinian diaspora community in other countries where things are not so polarized and where the thuggery of violence in everyday life might be able to moderate some of these passions and also be able to allow people to leave and to go out into less violent kinds of situations. But, you know, we've seen the Palestinian diaspora also be it's hard for people to get out because other nations don't want that to come into their own society and then have domestic suicide bombings and violence.
Sure.
And, you know, so, you know, it's a horrible conundrum.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not just simply a matter of wanting peace. You know, people are actively fighting for domination at all costs. And, you know, the threat of a domino effect of this spreading, you know, I think some of the other societies in the Middle East are susceptible to the same kind of polarization and to, in essence, civil war. And I think that's the horrible thing that may be unraveling right now with our Iraqi policy and with the kind of confrontational stance. And I think that we need to communicate understanding, but we also need to create tools that help people get out from under these, you know, life or death, no win situations. And I haven't heard too many people discuss, you know, practically, you know, what would you do if you were living in Gaza and, you know, would you ship your kids out? I'm sure a lot of people would if they possibly
sure.
could. So I guess that's my
thank
comment.
You. Thanks for your thoughtful comments, Professor Pettazur.
Yeah, I think that it's absolutely right. First, it's a civil war. It's quite clear. We can call it whatever we want, but it looks like a civil war. And then I think that we, you know, Hamas is now threatening that if international forces are going to be shipped to Gaza, they are going to treat them like Israeli forces. So it means that if we are talking about military intervention, it's not going to do well. It's not. Maybe it's going to make things a little safer, but not in the long run. And it will get more countries involved. I do think, and I do hope that mechanisms for helping civilians will be found, because I don't think that people in Gaza have a lot of money to ship outside of the Gaza Strip. Most people in Gaza are quite poor, but I would definitely, you know, I hope that the international community would be willing to accept kids and families from Gaza, because these people are innocent and there is no reason that they would be victims of violence. And again, I think that there should be mechanisms for channeling money into the region that would serve for humanitarian purposes and for the economy rather than for fighting, or that would be kept within the hands of few families or few leaders. And I think that one of the problems of Gaza was that for many years, money that came in after the Oslo agreements didn't reach the population. Gaza, some people became extremely rich, but most of the residents of Gaza stayed poor. So there is a, and this was one of the major causes that led Hamas to win the elections. They advocated this policy of anti-corruption policy, mm-hmm. but we don't see that they can live up to their commitment.
We're going to welcome our phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Ami Pettazur. He's an associate professor in the Departments of Government and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas. And we're talking about in Austin, and we're talking about the violence between Fatah and Hamas in Gaza Strip. And welcoming your calls. A couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Ami Pettazur is our guest, and we go back to phone calls now to Dave from Madison. Next, hi, Dave.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment, maybe a question to your guest. I personally feel that Hamas is a terrorist organization and that the Palestinian people have kind of made their own bet. And, you know, they have a terrorist organization representing their government. And until they recognize Israel as a state, you know, I mean, they don't come to the table. They don't give in to nothing. I mean, at least Israel has a democratic society. They are open-minded to try to work things out. But Hamas does not. And because they're a terrorist organization, you know, I don't want to send any of my tax money to help those people.
Would you classify them as terrorist organization, Professor Pettazur?
Well, oh boy, what a tough question. The Hamas, I would, for example, classify the Palestinian Islamic Jihad as a terrorist organization because this is a small group of fighters supported by Iran, which is, you know, everything that they are doing is focused on terrorist activities. Hamas, on the other hand, is based on a net of charitable associations that were established on the ideology of the Islamic of the Muslim Brothers in Egypt. So, in a way, they are far more than a terrorist organization. Yes, they do have the Azadin al-Qassam Brigades, which are networks of terrorists that are operating against Israel and the Fatah. But in general, they are much more than that. It's like Hezbollah. Sometimes we ask ourselves, what makes these movements so influential? And we have to keep in mind that they supply services that others fail to supply. So in this respect, I would see Hamas as a multi-layered group, an organization with many functions, and therefore it's hard for me to define it only as a terrorist group.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call. We go to John from Madison next. Hi, John.
Hi. I wanted to respect to another caller, a woman who gave, I think, what was one of the most concise explanations of just why the occupation is the problem. And the guest differed with her because she wasn't taking into account all the factors. And I think he misses the point because that's exactly what she was trying not to do. She was trying to get to the basic problem, which was the occupation. And I'm reminded of Yasser Arafat sitting on the pile of rubble that Israel, with the support of the United States, had reduced Fatah to after the Intifada. And I would remind the guests that it was Israel and the United States who reduced Fatah to the weakened state it was in when the elections were held. I also find it hard to believe that Israel didn't know the possibilities that would result from that. Fatah being seen as a corrupt organization and Hamas being seen as a sincere servant of the people. And I think that's what's brought us to where we are now.
Professor Pettazur.
Well, I'm not sure that Israel was smart by cracking down on Fatah, and I couldn't figure out myself why Arafat was held accountable during the beginning of the Second Intifada. There is still a debate about his role there, and I definitely didn't think that he orchestrated it. So in this respect, I agree. On the other hand, I wouldn't say that that Israel and the United States portrayed Fatah as a corrupt organization. There was a real issue of corruption there that we cannot overlook. And Hamas was mobilizing based on an agenda that was, you know, offering to cope with this corruption. So, again, I wouldn't. I don't want to make it a political debate because I really don't have. I'm not representing the Israeli government here, and I don't think that I would be, you know, that Olmert would support everything that I say. I just think that in a way it would be for me, and I accept any other view, it's impossible to reduce it to one factor. I do agree that the occupation has a lot of impact, and that Israel could be held accountable for many things that happened there. I just don't see it as a single factor.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. Let us go to Daryl from North Carolina. Hi, Daryl.
Hello.
How'd you find us?
Well, I got you here on the National Public Radio over there driving down the road.
Ah, okay.
But I believe my input on this matter is that this is a religious war, because both the Palestinians and Israel will never be able to coincide and exist beside each other, in the fact that the sites that both parties would like to have are their holy sites, and each side wants to build their temple to do their worship in their religion as they see. And I don't know, just to say peace is only going to do it, because neither side is going to give up the right to let each other to worship beside each other, because it'd be a slap in the face. But I'll take my y'all's comments off the air, if there is any.
All right, Daryl, there will be. Thanks for the call.
Well, I think that religion is definitely a factor in it, but we have to remember that in the past, Islam and Judaism were lived in coexistence. It's a matter of the last few decades. Jews lived in Muslim countries in peace, and gained prominence in different areas. I think that there is a religious issue there that is becoming more and more prominent. I think that it's definitely represented by the Hamas and the settler movement, but I think that still the majority of the people would trade this conflict and try to, or will be willing to find ways to coexist. And I think there are ways to, you know, if we address the question of Jerusalem, to come up with a creative solution to make Jerusalem accessible for both parties. And so therefore, I do acknowledge that religion is becoming more and more of an issue there, but I don't think that there is an inherent conflict between Judaism and Islam.
One more phone call. Helen from West Salem. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I just have two comments. One is about the democratic election of electing Hamas. It in some ways it was democratic, but when you consider that one half of the population in Jordan are Palestinians living in refugee camps and they were not allowed to vote, it isn't democratic like we think of it, because our people can live anywhere in the world and still vote in our elections. The other comment is, if Iran is getting involved, sending arms and so forth, they would be doing that because of our United States' support of Israel to the detriment of the Palestinians. That's my comment. Thank you.
Well, regarding democracy, I can only say that I'm an Israeli citizen who resides in the United States, and I cannot vote. Israeli citizens who do not live in Israel or are not present in Israel at the day of elections cannot vote. So it's just a question of how you define democratic elections. As for Iran, I think that Iran is a much bigger story than we tend to analyze it. And I think that for the last 5-6 years, the U.S. was very much preoccupied with the question of Al-Qaeda and the global Salafi jihad. I think that Iran, from my research and from what I see today, has a very a complicated agenda. It has very little to do with the Palestinians. It has a lot to do with their own interests in the region. And I think that it definitely requires much more research and much more analysis. And if I had one recommendation for you know, policymakers, is just, you know, take a look at what's going on in Iran very closely, because it's not only the nuclear issue, it's conventional weapons, it's terrorism, and this regime is very interesting and requires much more analysis.
Yeah, and is no friend of Israel, that's for sure, but that's an element that you can't discount.
Yeah, that's clear.
Right, yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I wish there were some clear-cut answers, some action that could be taken so that people don't have to live under this kind of violence.
It's, me too.
It's not good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our guest, Professor Ami Pedazor, who is an associate professor in the Departments of Government and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas, also a senior fellow at the National Security Studies Center at the University of Haifa in Israel. His main fields of interest are terrorism and political extremism. He serves as an associate editor of the journals Studies in Conflict and Terrorism and Democracy and Security, and is also the book review editor of the Civil Wars Journal. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Copies of this hour, call the radio store. Their phone number is 800-747-7444. And the program number of this particular hour is 614D, 614D. We have news ahead from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Thursday morning conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.